The Judaism of the Temple, of the Sanhedrin, of Jerusalem, had been shattered. And the question facing them all is, to what extent could it be put back together in the Academy of Yavne? Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 103, The Great Debate of Yavne. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Today, perhaps unexpectedly, we begin by speaking of Japanese pottery. I cite a passage from a book by Daniel Pink. Quote, "In the 15th century, or so the story goes, a Japanese shogun named Ashikaga Yoshimasa dropped a Chinese tea bowl which broke into several pieces when it hit the floor. He sent the damaged bowl back to China to be repaired. But what he received in return months later was an ungainly mess of an object, the bowl's pieces held together by bulky metal staples. There's got to be a better way, he thought, and he asked local craftspeople to find it. They chose to repair the pottery by sanding down the edges of the broken pieces and gluing them back together using lacquer mixed with gold. The artisan's goal wasn't to faithfully reproduce the original work or even to conceal its newly acquired flaws. It was to transform the piece into something better. Their work established a new and now centuries-old art form called kintsugi. By the 17th century, according to one report, kintsugi was such a fashionable phenomenon that some people were known to smash their tea bowls on purpose in order to embed them with golden-veined repairs." End quote. Pink cites this story in his book, The Power of Regret, where he argues against the common celebrity mantra, no regrets, because as Pink puts it, no regrets is no way to live. Pink further writes that, quote, "Kintsugi, which translates to golden joinery, considers the breaks and the subsequent repairs part of the vessel's history, fundamental elements of its being," end quote. And he adds, "What's true of ceramics can also be true for people," end quote. Interestingly, one of the greatest controversies affecting Jewish legal life soon after the destruction of Jerusalem seemed to have been about shattered pottery pieced together. Not a bowl, but an earthenware oven. And in truth, upon studying this case, we realize that the case is also about Jerusalem itself. In fact, upon closer consideration, it appears that kintsugi allows us to better understand the challenges facing the Jews of Yavne, as well as the beauty of the Judaism that emerged from it. We have previously seen how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stole out of Jerusalem, accompanied by two of his students, Rabbi Joshua and Rabbi Eliezer. As the Talmud describes, it was in Yavne that the two clashed, leading to the ultimate expulsion of Rabbi Eliezer from the academy due to his refusal to accept the majority decision of the rabbinic group there. Let us explain the legal case that inspired the controversy, as this will be essential for our understanding of the story. And here I expand on my explanation of this tale in my Tikva lectures on Avot. In order to become impure in Jewish ritual law, a vessel must be whole. And even if it becomes ritually defiled, if a vessel becomes shattered, it loses its impurity. The case in Yavne concerned an oven, a vessel, that was fragmented, destroyed, shattered into many pieces. It was then clumsily reformed, with the pieces held together by sand. Is this reformed oven considered a vessel? Can it become impure? Rabbi Eliezer said no. However functional such a vessel may be, it is not, according to Jewish law, considered an oven, because it is merely pieces. Rabbi Joshua, however, said that however imperfectly pieced together it may be, a vessel it still is, and it can become impure. There are several versions of this story in various parts of rabbinic literature. I utilize the Cencino translation of the tale from the Babylonian Talmud. Quote, "It has been taught, on that day Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. Said he to them, if the halacha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove it. Thereupon the carob tree was torn 100 cubits out of its place. Others affirm 400 cubits. No proof can be brought from a carob tree, they retorted. Again he said to them, if the halacha agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it. Whereupon the stream of water flowed backwards. No proof can be brought from a stream of water, they rejoined." End quote. In other words, Rabbi Eliezer, in this story, is attempting to prove by miracle that he is correct. The oven repaired is not an oven. It is still considered shattered pieces. The story continues, quote, "Again he urged, if the halacha agrees with me, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it. Whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Joshua rebuked them, saying, when scholars are engaged in halachic dispute, what have ye to interfere? Hence they did not fall in honor of Rabbi Joshua, nor did they resume the upright in honor of Rabbi Eliezer, and they are still standing thus inclined," end quote. We must understand the literary significance of this image. the walls of the academy at Yavne began to fall. Then they were halted by Rabbi Joshua. And, we are told, by the Babylonian Talmud, they still stand in diagonal position today. What does this mean? Yavne is long gone at the time the Babylonian Talmud was written. The meaning, perhaps, is that spiritually, neither Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Joshua is declared completely wrong. For, as the sages say when it comes to legal debate in the Torah Academy, Elu va'elu divrei Elokim chayim, these and these represent the words of the living God. But nevertheless, normative law must be decided, and the majority sided with Rabbi Joshua. Which brings us to the most famous part of the story. Rabbi Eliezer again turns to the sages, quote, "Again he said to them, 'If the halacha agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven.' Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, 'Why do ye dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters the halacha agrees with him?' But Rabbi Joshua arose and exclaimed, 'It is not in heaven.'" What did he mean by this? Said Rabbi Jeremiah, that the Torah had already been given at Mount Sinai. "We pay no attention to a heavenly voice, because thou hast long written in the Torah at Mount Sinai, after the majority must one incline." End quote. The point, in other words, is that the Torah given by God to human beings must be interpreted by human beings. Legal questions must be decided by the rabbis. And though the two opinions of the two sages may both be reflections of the infinite mind of God, on earth, the majority of the Sanhedrin decides. Rabbi Eliezer, refusing to accept the ruling of the rabbinic body, was declared a rebel against his colleagues and was placed in a form of excommunication, which involved not only placing a ban on him in the present, but also retroactively revoking all decisions regarding ritual impurity that he had declared in the past. The Talmud continues, quote, "On that day, all objects which Rabbi Eliezer had declared clean were brought and burnt." And the story adds, "Then they took a vote and excommunicated him." End quote. Then, in a heartbreaking scene, Rabbi Eliezer's beloved student Rabbi Akiva, whom we shall discuss very soon, was sent to inform him in order to ensure that the rabbi not overreact too strongly and bring destruction upon them all. Quote, said they, "Who shall go and inform him?" "I will go," answered Rabbi Akiva, "lest an unsuitable person go and inform him and thus destroy the whole world." What did Rabbi Akiva do? He donned black garments and wrapped himself in black and sat at a distance of 4 cubits from him. "Akiva," said Rabbi Eliezer to him, "what has particularly happened today?" "Master," he replied, "it appears to me that thy companions hold aloof from thee." Thereupon he too rent his garments, put off his shoes, removed his seat, and sat on the earth, whilst tears streamed from his eyes. End quote. Thus is Rabbi Akiva excommunicated, with the ban being lifted only at the moment of his death. It is here that we must ask the obvious question. Does not Rabbi Eliezer know that the decisions of the Sanhedrin is decided by majority vote? He too knows the verse in the Torah which explicitly states, "Acharei Rabbim Lahatot," after the majority must thou incline. The answer, it would seem, is that following the destruction of the temple, Rabbi Eliezer believed that the Sanhedrin's authority had dissipated. Recall, as we explained in earlier episodes, that the original site of the Sanhedrin was in the Lishkat HaGazit, the chamber of hewn stone in the temple complex, and as we further noted, it must have been assumed that there was a special supernatural link between some of the most serious decisions issued by the Sanhedrin and the divine guidance inspiring the judges as they sat within the sacred sphere. However, in Yavne, not only had the Sanhedrin ceased to sit in the temple had been destroyed, and the Sanhedrin had departed Jerusalem itself. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein put it this way, quote, "Rabbi Eliezer maintained that once the Sanhedrin was exiled from its place and the sages no longer convened in Jerusalem, he was no longer obligated to accept their view. The sages, on the other hand, maintained, after the majority to incline, even when the Sanhedrin is no longer sitting in the chamber of hewn stone, the Lishkat HaGazit, their traditions and rulings are binding." End quote. In other words, for Rabbi Eliezer's colleagues, the rules of the Sanhedrin still applied, the destruction of Jerusalem notwithstanding. And that is why Rabbi Eliezer's position was so problematic to his colleagues. Rabbi Eliezer was not only presenting an interesting approach to vessels and ritual purity. In the debate over this question, his refusal to adopt the majority vote, or at least accept it as authoritative, meant that according to him, the Sanhedrin no longer existed. And what this means is that amidst the seemingly technical legal discussion, there is a deeper debate that is taking place, and we can see the literary imagery, the sublime symbolism in this Talmudic tale. An oven has been shattered. Its fragments were pieced back together. This is not only a legal complexity, but also a metaphor, a tale of cosmic kintsugi, for the Judaism of the temple of the Sanhedrin of Jerusalem had been shattered. And the question facing them all is, to what extent could it be put back together in the Academy of Yavne? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had fled a fragmenting temple in a smoldering city, and after Jerusalem's fall, he had reassembled rabbinic authority and a Jewish community piece by piece as best as he could. Had he succeeded? The question pertained to the very essence and continuity of Judaism itself. That is why the rabbis had to do the unthinkable, excommunicating their beloved colleague, because his opinion threatened the continuity of Judaism itself. The loss of Rabbi Eliezer to the rabbinic colloquium was devastating. Recall that, according to one source, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai considered Rabbi Eliezer his greatest student, one whose photographic memory outweighed the gifts of all the others. Nevertheless, this event seems to have been essential to the Sanhedrin's survival, and therefore to the composition of the Mishnah several generations later. I went online to study examples of kintsugi, broken pottery, melded back together, with its cracks still showing. They are indeed beautiful, with gold lines running through them. Beautiful, while still profoundly imperfect. Beautiful, with the breaks testifying to the shattering that had occurred. As the writer Tiffany Ayuda describes, quote, in kintsugi, every break is unique, and the technique actually highlights the scars as part of the design, end quote. It is true, as we have said, that Jewish observance suffered a severe setback from the destruction of the temple, and more setbacks are yet to come in the story that we tell. Yet what came forth from Yavne's kintsugi after the destruction was a glorious intellectual heritage that ultimately produced a Mishnah and the Talmud, stunning and extraordinary in so many respects. Pondering the history of the Torah, Torah study, and rabbinic life after the destruction, one thinks of the Yiddish statement from the poem Eifen Pripichik, in which the teacher in the cheder tells the students, Azir vet kinderlech elter veren, vet ir allein verstehen, wifel in die oisies liegen schweren, und wie viel gewein. When you become older, dear children, you will understand on your own how many tears, how much suffering lie in these letters of the Torah. The Torah, as it is passed down through the centuries, bears the scars, the kintsugi, made golden by God's grace. But the Torah that emerges from Yavne, the rabbinic literature that emerges from Yavne, is nonetheless a glory to the Jewish world to this day. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.